Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today and next week, our guest will be Tony Alvarez. Tony Alvarez is an investor that has bought and sold a lot of properties, and he now lectures all over California and even outside of the state of California, and he's written a book, Breaking into REO Business, How I Went from Bankruptcy to $7.2 million in 7 years, Making Friends. Tony, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bruce. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Did you ever think you'd write a book?
No.
What started this idea germinating?
To be very frank with you, this idea all got started with the very first time that you asked me to speak, actually. Many years ago, after I had gotten pretty successful buying and selling REO properties, you came to me one time and you said, if I would... I was very guarded, okay? People would offer to take me to lunch and all that kind of stuff, wanting to know what I did. And I always turned them down. I never had a lunch with anybody. You know, in my whole career, I never made time to do that. I was pretty quiet. And you asked me, as part of a Millionaire Maker series that you did, a pretty big event, you asked me if I would please go there and kind of divulge and disclose what I had done. Because it seemed like I made a lot of money within a very short amount of time, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I really was a little bit beside myself because I thought, what am I going to do with this place? It was all professional investors and stuff, and I never looked at myself like that. You know, I saw myself as a regular guy just working really hard. But you made me think. I had to go introspectively and sit down, and my computer is a yellow pad. I had to ask myself a lot of questions, and I even went to you and I said, you know, I'm a little nervous about the whole thing, and I don't know if you recall, but you did something that was very instrumental. You said to me, what are you nervous about? I said, well, you know, I'm going to get in front of these people. And you said, well, did you really do this? I said, well, yeah. And that made me step back a little bit, you know. And you said, you don't plan on lying to anybody, do you? And I thought, no. And you said, well, and those two questions stood me right up straight. And I sat down and I started thinking about what I did and did I buy houses? Did I do this? Did I do that? And I kept coming up with answers that other people do. You know, I bought houses at 50 cents on the dollar or better sometimes, or I got them fixed up at a pretty good price. You know, I negotiated well with workers and stuff. Oh, well, everybody else did that too, you know.
And I'm going to interrupt for just a second because what you're about to say is how the whole event was structured intentionally.
Right.
Because if you thought about the speakers, you know, we had Jack Fullerton and we had Mike Cantu and we had Charles Harris and we had you and myself. Everyone had a different skill set, and I wanted the audience to look at one of us and go, I can replicate that.
Very good, yes.
And that worked out. Do you remember the position I gave you as far as when you spoke?
Oh, yeah, I was last man on the totem pole.
No, you weren't last man on the totem pole. You were last, but the totem pole actually was inverted because I tell you what, I did not want anyone to follow you because I knew in advance of you that you were going to knock it out of the park.
You know what? I have to tell you honestly, you knew much better than I because I was petrified. I was scared. 5 minutes, I'm at the door and I'm looking through the glass and you're out there introducing me and I was I was frozen. I never in my life thought that I would have had the response that I got from that audience. So, indeed, I have to give it to you, and I've told you many times, you're much wiser than I because you saw something in me that I had not seen in myself.
That reaction of the audience surprised you then?
Oh, it floored me. I mean, they literally, I was supposed to speak for 2 hours, of course. I got lost in my presentation and blew right through the 2 hours. And someone in the audience, I remember, jumped up and said, cancel whoever's coming up behind him. And we want, can you give him more time and all that? I had never spoken publicly.
Yeah.
Which I had fibbed to you about, actually, because you had asked me, you said, you've spoken before. I said, well, come on, hey. This is me. Of course I've spoken, and I hadn't, you know. You were – I respect you quite a bit because you're able to see things that other people don't see. You see things, and you're able to put together little pieces, and I've mentioned this many times before to other folks as well. I admire that about you because you're able to bring together – a little bit from this place, a little bit, and then you put it together and you make something better than all those individual pieces. In fact, that event, I know, I witnessed people that went to that event and ended up becoming millionaires as a result of attending that event. So that's pretty powerful stuff.
It is, and I think the audience was in front of the right group of speakers, because that was a wide range of skill sets, and I didn't want them just to isolate on one person and say, okay, I can be exactly like them, but take from each of those people the best, perhaps, that they could put into themselves. And if it had an effect, that's probably what happened. Let's go back to your beginning in a way, because I think that's somehow instrumental in where you ended up. You didn't really have a real estate background growing up as a kid. You weren't around real estate.
No.
As a matter of fact, you could tell us a little bit about, you came from Cuba.
Yeah, well, my parents came. They brought us from Cuba in 1960, you know, right after the Castro Revolution. We spent very little time in Florida because my parents wanted us to really become, you know, assimilate and become American and learn the language and stuff. So my parents quickly moved us up to Lawrence, Mass. And we were poor. I mean, you know, we lived at the International Institute in Lawrence, Massachusetts. You know, we lived with indigents. I mean, it was a one-room, 10-by-10 room with one mattress on the floor, and that was my three brothers, my mom, my dad, and my grandmother, and we all slept there. And, you know, used the bathroom, common bathroom down the hallway and the common kitchen, and if you missed your time to cook, you didn't eat.
But you came away with a sense of opportunity was possible.
Absolutely, absolutely. We don't complain about anything, okay? I mean, you've got to understand that... We used to play. My first playground was the alleyway behind the International Institute, and I was ecstatic to be there. By the way, we'd never seen snow. In the first winter, we were in Lawrence, Mass. We had the largest snowstorm in the history of New England, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But we were in heaven. Our clothes came from the Catholic Church. You know, it's almost like what they do now when, you know, you have, like, the Salvation Army, that kind of thing. But people were very good to us, you know, and you go through the same things that anybody goes through when you're, you know, we were the first Spanish-speaking family in that area. It was mostly Irish and Italian and whatnot. But I only have good memories, and the first guy who we rented from, Mr. Folletti, my dad and my mom ended up buying a three-tenement home from him, no money down. So that was my first exposure to a no-money-down deal.
Okay.
Where he actually talked my parents into buying that from him, because they said, you're never going to really have something of your own here unless, you know, you go from being a tenant to being an owner. And then they went on to buy the one across the street and stuff. But my dad used to make us fix up, you know, the units, these three tenements. I hated it. I want you to know, back then when I was a kid, I mean, that to me was like torture.
What was the biggest lesson your dad taught you think?
Straight out of the gate was just put your head down and just work harder than anybody else. And, you know, just don't look back. There's nothing else is more important than that. Stay focused on what you want to get accomplished and just do it.
And your mom, what did she add to that?
My mom is all about people and all about relationships. And I'll just tell you one short thing. when we were kids, when we came, they had to get jobs. You know, my dad had worked in the clerk of courts in the same courthouse where my grandfather was a judge in Cuba. So he'd never really done hard labor or anything. When they got here, he had to go wash dishes. My mom became a maid. So my mom worked as a maid for a place called Phillips Academy near the a place called the Andover Inn. The Kennedys would visit this place. My grandmother was diagnosed with terminal cancer, breast cancer, so she wanted to go back and die in Cuba. And obviously we couldn't afford the ticket, you know, having just gotten here. So my mom met, while cleaning their rooms, she met Bobby Kennedy, befriended them. When they found out my mom was from Cuba, I want you to know, they were more interested in her than she was interested in Bobby Kennedy, because my mom at that time really didn't know who Bobby Kennedy was. Well, anyways, they end up getting my grandmother back on a plane to Cuba. So to this day, my mom is a hardcore Democrat. I, on the other hand, am somewhat conservative. We have a lot of fun during the holidays at my house when we have debates. Now, my mom doesn't know that much about the political thing, but all she knows is the Kennedys got my grandmother back on a plane to Cuba. So, you know, they're right under sainthood, you know.
But her skill set
was all about people.
But it was loving people.
Yes. She taught me, and here's a quote right from my mom. You can accomplish anything you want to accomplish in your life. You can go anywhere you want to go. You can meet anyone, no matter how rich or famous, as long as you learn to love people first.
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 Okay.
That's very important.
That was the great privilege for me in writing the foreword, because that's what I've observed. That's different. And what you have given to this industry by this book is the concept that this is not about a manipulation.
Right.
This is about a heartfelt concern about who you're sitting across from and how it's working out for them. And it doesn't matter if it's a realtor or an owner or whoever it is. I know they feel that. And that was in the description in this foreword, is that if you think that's easy, you have to rethink that, because it gets back to intent. Stephen Covey, and I mentioned that in the foreword, about the speed of trust.
Right.
That's what people feel from you, is what that audience felt that day, the first day, is they felt, Tony loves us. I trust him.
Yeah, that's true. And they even wrote it on the board.
Yeah.
When we finally broke for lunch, we came back from lunch, and someone had written behind the board, which I hadn't noticed at first, "We love you, Tony." And that was, for me, I'll tell you, that made my day, because I know that that's true.
Yeah.
You see? Which is, and you're right in what you're saying. You know, I went through a lot of changes as I matured as a business person. I have to admit, in the 80s, I was out there, I wasn't taking any prisoners. I was out there all about the money, you know.
What years was that?
Like 1980 to like the end of the 80s, like 89. You know, I was riding a crest there where it was just like, I'm going for the money. I wanted to get rich, and I didn't really pay attention to much reason why. At the end of that, I pretty much I got out of real estate because I was burnt out. But I have to tell you what I learned. This is you know. This wonderful book is full of what I have learned in my life in this business, what's made me wealthy. So it's a kind of a no-nonsense kind of thing. What I learned at the end of the 80s was I was completely burnt out, didn't want to have anything to do with real estate. I took all my money I had made, put it into another business, promptly lost it all, okay? And I think it was almost a way of punishing myself for the way I had accumulated that money. Now, everybody has a different way of thinking. I was brought up Catholic, so, you know, we're injected with guilt and a complex and a conscience, you know.
Okay.
But when I started back in business again, when I started back in real estate back in 1995 after having gone through bankruptcy, because, I mean, I started from nothing again. I wanted to find a different way of doing this. I figured there has to be a better way of doing this than just getting out there and making money at someone else's expense. I did not want to do that again. I had done that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had done it well. And doing that well doesn't accomplish anything for your life, I want you to know. So when I came back, I modeled myself. I'll tell you what. When I got back in the business, back then, the Antelope Valley, which is where I started buying again, was known as the foreclosure capital of the United States. So when I went out there, they had a lot of HUD homes and all this kind of stuff, and everybody was fighting tooth and nail over these homes. And I thought, no, I've done that already. You know, I don't want to go back and do that kind of thing. So what I did was I looked for other avenues of opportunity, and what I found was there was a lot of what they call REO agents, mm-hmm. Real estate-owned agents. And REO just stands, it's a term that the banks use for their foreclosure properties. And what I did was I realized that these brokers that represent these REO properties for these lenders had to have someone that would buy this inventory from them, but you have to fit a certain mold to be successful at this. Because it's somewhat about the numbers, no doubt. But if you want to create relationships with these people that are going to pay off over years, it's got to be about who you are as an individual. So what I did was I zeroed in on what they were looking for. And all I did was model myself to be that person. Now, luckily, it turned out to be the two things, the two primary things in the foundation of becoming that individual were the two things I learned from my parents. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Work hard, harder than anybody else. Focus on your own plate, you know? You're eating, you know, because we're a big family, right? So we'd eat, and I'd always be looking at what my brother had. My mother would say, pay attention to your own plate. Never mind what's on his.
Okay.
Okay? Focus on that. Work hard. But you have to care about what's important to other people. And one of the things that I say that really made the difference for me is you might experience success if you're good at performance, meaning if you're good at doing, you know, knowing how to fix a house or knowing how to buy it at the right price or sell it or whatever. But you really don't experience the opportunity to participate in long-term success for yourself unless you get to understand that you have to learn to love your business associates. And there's a very specific definition of love there. It's not the huggy, kissy, lovey body, although I'm known for kissing a lot of people, not necessarily on the lips, but, you know. You have to learn to love your business associates and care about their successes as much as your own. If you miss that lesson, you put yourself in a category along with a whole bunch of other people where you're constantly competing for new business. I do not compete with anybody for business. I spend very little time going after new business. The majority of my business life is basically revolved around answering my phone and saying, how you doing? How's your family? Oh, you got, okay, yes, I'll take that. Or you know what? I don't think that's right for me. That's it. But usually it's a yes because the guys on the other end have gotten to know you so well that they don't call you with something that's not right for you. They know you well enough to know they're caring for you too. See, they're watching out for you. Now, that's a symbiotic relationship.
Well, what's interesting about what you had to do in the 90s was you started from scratch.
Right.
Where you couldn't go in with any bragging rights about, I've got this bank statement, or there's a lot of burden that investors put on them that they're not something.
Exactly.
Well, you had a lot of the list of I'm not something,
right,
and that you had to overcome.
Yes.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about that journey in the beginning. You're sitting in front of an REO agent with access to some hard money. What sequence did you put the pieces together and say, okay, I'm ready to go?
Yeah, the first thing I did was I went out to find the property.
Okay.
I went out to look at the area because I read this article that said there was the foreclosure capital of the United States. I got to go find out if this is for real.
So it wasn't necessarily where you lived. You just thought that's where the opportunity is.
Exactly. Actually, yeah, I was living in the Burbank area, and this place was the Antelope Valley, which is about an hour and 15 minutes, hour and a half drive out.
Okay.
So I went out there. I had to borrow my dad's car, I want you to know, because I didn't have wheels. Okay. I lost them when I went through bankruptcy. Not a good thing if you're living in Southern California.
No.
I drove out there, got off on the first street, the first Palmdale Boulevard, got off there, took a right, drove two blocks, saw a house for sale on a street called Robina, right next to an apartment complex. Not a great location, I want you to know. And I called up, it's $37,000. Three-bedroom, one bath, 1,000 square feet. Well, I knew because I had been an appraiser for a long time, and we skipped over that, but I had already worked as an appraiser for a while, real estate appraiser. That house would cost $100,000 to build that day. Okay, so mm-hmm. I knew if I can buy this house for $37,000, I don't even have to negotiate price here. I can't replicate that. And then I found out that the rent on that house was anywhere from $650 to $850, depending on who I wanted for a tenant.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a no-brainer. It's not a question of whether you're going to buy it or not. Is how many can you buy, how quickly? So now I got to go find the elements of making this happen.
Okay.
I got fired up. I was excited. I was like, okay, this is my ticket out of the pizza making place, because that's another thing we missed. Okay, when I went down the tubes, I had to take a job at a pizza place. Okay,
and walk there too.
Yeah, I walked. It wasn't that far away, but you know, it was because I lost my spirit. You know, I took a big hit when I lost everything. So I was, people think, well, you're already an appraiser and stuff. Yeah, but you know, when you take a hit, the first thing you look at every morning is your face in that mirror, and you're saying to yourself, "How stupid are you?"
And you look at what you don't have instead of what you have.
Sure, you focus on, you know, you don't trust your own decision-making ability anymore.
What did you learn about yourself coming out of that?
Boy, that's a... You're reminding me of that guy who interviews the football players and gets them to cry.
That's okay.
Yeah. Well, I learned...
If anything, this book is about feeling.
Yes. Yeah. I learned that at the core, I am still who my parents wanted me to be. So
that's the ultimate tiebreaker, by the way.
Right.
Isn't that a neat gift?
Yeah.
Is that love that you have is the ultimate tiebreaker and has opened all the doors. And it's interesting because a lot of people think they have to assemble all these pieces and become great at them. And what happens after trust exists because of that base of, I like his intent.
Right.
A lot of that can be assembled after the fact.
That's the only thing I had to rely on, Bruce. You know, I mean, when you strip away all the nonsense, you know, when you strip away all the stuff about money making and all that other nonsense, you get down to who you really are, and that's all you can bring to the table. So your question earlier was, you know, when you go in there to speak to an REO broker, a professional guy, you know, who's got this big title, the title is almost in these huge capital letters out in front of him, you know. And I like to say that if I've done anything right, I've gotten to the person behind the title. But I'm going to tell you something, and, you know, some folks are out there thinking that, you know, where's the secret recipe? I'll tell you what. When you have nothing, when you have no ammunition, when you have no sword or nothing to wield in this meeting, you're left with the truth. And that's where I went. I went to, okay, let me tell you who I am and what I've done. And I told them the truth of my situation. I didn't lie to them. I didn't pretend that I had all this money and that I had all this influence or that I, you know.
They hear enough of that too, by the way, don't they?
yeah, they do.
And they discount it too.
Well, who of us cannot see a guy lying to him? If we want to ignore it, that's a choice we make. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is, when somebody comes at you and they're doing that whole pom-pom song and dance thing, the bottom line is, you can tell they're lying to you, or they're being disingenuous. So I didn't have enough strength in that moment to go in there and even try to pretend to be someone else. This is who I am. And I told them the truth.
Now, what's unique, and let me just direct this for just a sec. You drive off an off-ramp and you find a product, but you didn't go find more product. What you did is you started thinking.
The elements.
There are pieces to this puzzle, and there was the person that controlled the product who ultimately would become more important than the product itself.
Absolutely. So, I was looking for the person who could, in essence, who could teach me who I needed to be. Okay? I know about the product. I mean, I'd been an appraiser. I know how to identify a deal like that.
Right.
But, you know, there was a lot of other elements. And what I wanted was, there's somebody at the end of this that is going to say yes or no. And I had done that. Remember, I worked in-house for banks, Great Western Bank, Glendale Federal Bank. Those were real jobs I had, and I got to see what really happens inside. Well, this REO guy, whoever he is, or person, I mean, REO guy or woman,
sure.
Yeah, because I dealt with both, they need someone. They need someone on the other end. And it's all about certain things that really have very little to do with money. Everyone's looking for, you know, I got to show them a fat bank account, stuff like that. You do have to show that you can perform, obviously. If you can't perform, you're out of the game. But it goes beyond that because a lot of people can perform, right?
That's right.
So, you know, there's 20 horses in that race. We can all run really well, you know. Who can keep coming back, you know? Who's the secretariat here of the whole situation, you know?
And they don't usually just tell you the list.
No. In many, honestly, what I found over time was that even the REO agents that I was working with, for the most part, they know what they're looking for, but they don't live with that thought uppermost in their mind. It's almost a process of elimination by your own behavior. You know, what is it that you're going to do to get you out of this group?
Well, don't they already feel that they have the A-list, that one more is not necessary?
No.
Really?
No. As a matter of fact, they have a list of people who they do business with, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, unlike a marriage where you fall in love, you marry someone, and that's it. Now, you don't get a choice to go out, keep looking for the new person that's going to beat out the one you already have, okay? That doesn't work. This is a commitment that they have where they have all these people that they work with. But for the most part, they've developed a relationship built on performance. And that's it. Now, comes along a new guy who can perform just like everybody else, but now he wants to learn a little bit more. He doesn't want to cancel the transaction with you once he finds out it's not profitable because he knows you got to answer to somebody too, and I would never do anything to hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That goes beyond the numbers.
They start finding out a priority system that you have is a step above.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And then you become someone different than everybody else just in that decision.
But don't they think they already have that A-list? And because it's sort of like covered. In other words, it's hard to get in, and all of a sudden –
No, it is. It's true. They have a list, every REO broker, and if they say any different, they're not telling you the truth. But they have a list of people who they go to all the time, and even to the extent that they know which ones buy what kind of inventory. So, yeah, they do have that. And it is difficult to get your foot in that door. I'm not going to make it sound like it's a piece of cake. I mean, you walk in there and you tell them you love them. That's not going to get you on the list. Absolutely not.
Well, what's interesting is you did find a way to do it very successfully. We're going to continue this conversation on our next segment, Breaking into the REO Business, How I Went from Bankruptcy to $7.2 million in 7 Years While Making Friends. I can tell you, he makes a great friend as well. Tony, thanks for joining us,
Thank you.
We'll pick this up in the next segment.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.